satin balloons till I won. And I drank all the lemonade, drove bumper cars till it seemed like I owned the whole bar. And wherever I went, well, I shook every hand. I said, welcome to my wonderland. I said, welcome to our wonderland.
The Rule Book and Calendar of Kittery Embers, Chapter 6, Engloomed. Kittery stood before a blurred painting. An inky smear of sun hovered above a grey and brown ironworks ocean. She stared at the vast picture, deeply studied it, as though the painter had requested her opinion. With some concentration, she could make out the right edge of the canvas, where a small fishing village ran along a quiet coast, white stone houses over a yellow beach, with a shadowed comb of green hills behind. Directly below, she could see her legs painted into the water, pale stems folding in the glassy curls of light and wave. Though her eyes were open, her body was numb, and she could not move, which, she supposed, meant that she was dreaming. After falling into the cinders at Meadowlark, she must have fallen asleep. As she waited to wake up, she noticed a velvet freshness in the leaden dots and white dashes that made up the waves. The water appeared to be moving, or at least trembling, against itself. As the dream continued, it soon seemed to Kittery that the faraway waves were beginning to heave and mass. If the world was waking up, she thought, maybe she was too. But her hands hung like empty gloves from hollow imitation arms. But there was a sound now, too, of water and wind, half whistle, half explosion. The roughness of the paint dissolved. The overlapping smear and blur of the colours streamed together until the painting had become a crystal clear photograph. And yet, everything in the photograph, besides herself, was moving and fully alive. The iron sea clashed and shouted beneath a glossy pink sky. The pot-bellied clouds puffed along like high, weightless machines. At some point, the impossible idea arrived that she was, somehow, after all, awake. That this was not a painting or moving picture of the sea, but the sea itself. But why had the cinders taken her here? And where was her grandfather? The water was rising, the tide moving in. A wave rolled across her cheek. The salt water must have filled her mouth, but she couldn't taste it. Bigger waves built themselves in serrated rolls and were coming her way. A wall of water rammed against her face, and the droplets fell like rain from her forehead. She couldn't feel them, but each glistening drop was perfectly real. Another wave hit, higher this time, washing away her vision for a moment. The water rose and the waves crashed until she was standing beneath the frenzy, buried in a green catacomb of ocean. There were small fish flitting overhead in the occasional, slow, sand-trawling crab. The waves battled on the surface above her and the light slowly extinguished until there was nothing to see but a shrouded darkness. Kittery couldn't help but imagine the dream painter working over a fresh canvas, his newest painting of a little girl standing all alone at the bottom of the dark and silent sea. All along to Sweden, a train that don't ever leave the station.
a little time,
trying not to notice
how tumble down,
tired, weak and lonely
I am. I am.
Darcy woke in a pile of black and white bird feathers. He sniffed the crooked air. It smelled of coal and frost, like a fire smothered in ice chips. He examined his paws for signs of singeing, but his fur was fine, clean, and freshly brushed. "We have been struck by blue lightning, Wizzywig," he said loudly to the bird below him. As Darcy sat up, the worm around his neck stirred with life. "Unwiss is alive," Darcy called. He froze at the utterance and stared at the worm's plump ends. "Now how did I know your name was Unwiss, little worm?" Darcy asked, but Unwiss did not respond. Darcy rolled onto his paws to test his balance on the springy feathers. None of his legs had been disintegrated by the blue bolt, which had been a lingering worry. He marched to the upper wing and set his ear against the ridge of the bird's chest feathers. His nose sank deeply in the soft down, but finally he heard the gratifying pitter-pat of life. "Wizzywig, you are alive, if you didn't know," Darcy told his still-stunned friend. He patted the spot where the bird's heart beat and then regarded the landscape. "A most peculiar colored grass, Wizzy," he said, for the woodpecker's possible benefit. "Lime-coloured, and above us a bright, cloud-silver sky. In the distance, a kind of torn-down black mountain, enclosed in all sorts of chimney smoke. There's a strong smell of burning coal, so I suppose something nearby is on fire, but I don't know what." Despite the disturbing habitat, Darcy felt strangely good, shimmered by the bolt, well-rested and clean and light as air. "You'd think you'd feel crushed or shred," he said, continuing his general survey. "Lightning is something on the order of 50,000 degrees Fahrenheit, so you'd think you might feel somewhat heated or singed, burned somewhere, at least. But I must say I feel excellent." As he walked down the wing, it occurred to Darcy that he had never known much about lightning, other than it was bright and pretty. How was it that he knew how hot a lightning bolt could be? 50,000 degrees Fahrenheit? Where had that come from? He considered the possibility that things might be different now that he'd been filled with electricity. He might be faster, for example, his hearing sharper, but the most likely improvement seemed to be located in the area of his formerly leaky brain boat. He was much, much smarter, wasn't he? Or, not exactly smarter, but he knew things. Wasn't that the difference? He knew things that he didn't know, or hadn't before, or couldn't, but now could. The worm's name, for example, the temperature of lightning. And he'd never been the sort of mouse who knew anything about bird hearts. He clapped his mouth open and shut a few times. There was a definite parch. Water was something critical. For all of them, he supposed. They could all do with a nice cool drink after the blue electrocution. "Wizzywig," he called back to the still unconscious bird, "you stay here and rest. We're going off to get water from that circle pond. We won't be long." Darcy resettled Unwiss around his neck in a gentle cross and bounced down the springy wing, feeling as light as the feathers he was trampling. As he began to bustle through the lime blades, he felt the pleasant snap of being very much back on track. They were all alive. They were getting a bit of water, While it was true they didn't know where Kittery was, an order of a very subtle sort had been restored. Dossie nosed between the stems and stalks until his whiskers steered him shortly into an increasingly congested grove of green pillars. Old Dossie wouldn't have known it, but lightning-brained Dossie did. The thickened, formidable grass meant they were near the water. The grass mounded up, and suddenly he was peering at a reflection of himself in the glassy surface of the black pond. "Nothing like a good set of whiskers," he said warmly to them. Dossie checked his tongue to the black pond. It tasted of puddles. "A quick field test," he said to Unwith. He sampled another droplet and swirled the liquid around. He wouldn't want to set the worm down in a sick-making pond. As he waited for signs of poisoning, lightheadedness, cramping, he observed four wooden ducks spinning around the surface like tops. He hadn't seen them from the air, and he bristled uncomfortably at their smooth facades and aimless twirlings. It wasn't practical, nor an entertainment of any kind, to have wooden ducks on a lonely pond in a place like this. "Either it's a warning or invitation, Mr. Unwith," he said to the worm with the tone of a pondering detective. In the old pre-lightning days, his leaky brain boat would not have permitted the development of a follow-up thought. But it did now. "If it's an invitation," Dossie reasoned, "it's likely a trap. But since we are here, and as yet untrapped, it may be a warning. But if I remain unpoisoned, then we may temporarily assume the ducks are not a warning, that they are, after all, an invitation. So if they are, after all, in fact, an invitation, what are they inviting us to?" "Oh, I don't like where I've ended up in this line of thinking, Mr. Unwith." Dossie lifted the worm from around his neck. For some reason, Unwith seemed to be putting up a fight. To allay the struggling worm's fears, Dossie said firmly, "Of course it goes without saying that you and I must proceed with utmost caution, Mr. Unwith." And then, as though it were a comedy whose larger perspective required the opposite course, Dossie tucked the worm along the shallow edge of the pond. The moment his paws released the worm, Dossie's leaky brain boat sprung all its former leaks. Everything he knew about hearts and worms and lightning bolts turned into a mushy vapor and then melted into nothingness. Yet, in that in-between and hand-off moment, Dossie realized an unexpected truth. It was not the lightning that had brought him acuity and knowledge. It was the worm. Unwith had all along been the secret ingredient of his better brain. But a moment later, even this turned into a fog and floated off, and Dossie was left alone and clueless, staring at the worm and the pond as though he'd never seen either of them before in his life. He sat for a while in familiar, flustered blankness at the ruffled edge of the little pond. Whatever he'd been up to lately, he certainly hadn't had enough to drink. He tipped his nose into the water and supped. It tasted of good, old-fashioned puddle. He looked at the worm at the water's edge. It occurred to Dossie that he might know this worm somehow. He was not alone with his interest. One of the toy ducks had trembled across the pond and was moving rapidly toward the creature. Its bill was open and its head skimming the water top. From its belly, a long rod descended darkly into the depths. Perhaps, Dossie thought, this was a very fun pond, where children came and played games. They might toss sticks or rings around for the toy ducks to scoop up. Dossie watched the duck scoop the little worm at the water's edge into his bill. Its neck straightened, the beak clamped shut around the dangling pink body, and then the duck shot down into the water. Dossie gasped at the suddenness. Could that really be a fun game for children? To have the object of play gobbled into the invisible dark depths? Dossie didn't think so. A second duck had skimmed over, its mechanical beak opened expectantly. "I'm not playing," Dossie called out to it. He heard a footstep then, big and solid behind him, and his claws sank with fear into the dirt. "Where are you, my little friend from long ago?" a crackly old voice sang out from above. "Oh, you probably don't remember me," the old voice continued. "Very least, you wouldn't recognize me. But it is me, my little friend. It is me, Kittery." Dossie froze at the name and nervously peered through the limy blades at the old woman. She wore a brown scrap of dress, and her wrinkled face was hidden in a waterfall of white hair. "Ah, good," she said, counting the ducks. "Towdy Duck has already dropped with Miss Thrunwith. Go out into the water, Dossie. Barton Duck will convey you along to our new home. Oh, what fun we'll have, and you'll love it there. A bright old palace on a hill." The old woman swung something suddenly into the air, and Dossie stared at the watery splash on the far side of the pond. There was a vaguely familiar pile of black and white feathers floating near one of the wooden ducts. "Supper time, restin'," the old woman called, and laughed at her little joke. The wooden duck, named Restin, bit down upon the woodpecker's wings and dragged the larger bird down into the water. The old woman hobbled weakly over the grassy edge and splashed into the shallows. "Time to go," she said quietly to herself. She took a few more steps and then fell forward into the pond. She took a deep breath as one of the last ducks jitted quickly toward her. She extended her hand toward it, and its wooden beak bit down. "Take your time, of course, Dossie," the old woman said. She took a final, short gasp, and the duck sank like a stone, pulling her down into the darkness. Dossie felt the stinging bite around his belly, and before he could even take a helpful breath, his face hit the hard water, and he was plunging down toward the bottom of the little black pond. Behind a row of white stone houses, on the smooth ridge of Second Hill, Mrs. Keepsie Gramshaw, Partial Minister Rudyard Battlegrass, and about 20 other villagers of the town of Olive stood in anxious vigil around a polished lodestone. The villagers were mostly older fishermen in green and brown woolen overalls and council ladies in brightly checkered skirts. "How long has it been?" Mrs. Haggard asked.
"Too long," Mr. Wellfleet replied.
"Could she have gotten stuck in the in-between?"
Mrs. Elan wondered. No one's ever gotten stuck in the in-between, Mr. Dodge said.
Or arrived in a place other than the stone?
Mrs. Bunkle suggested.
Is it possible, Mrs. Gramshaw, for someone to go back, once they've started over, I mean?
Mrs. Haggard asked. But the tall housekeeper did not hear the questions. Her complete attention was on the glossy span of rock below her. Because she was so deeply occupied, the villagers reluctantly set their concern with the PM, as they called the partial minister. Since passing to the stone, that older gentleman had waited on a tuft of weed on the path that declined toward the village. Several times he had come close to ordering everyone back to their homes. But the partialness of his powers would be put to the test, and he couldn't, at the moment, stomach the idea of being ignored. To brush them away, that he might better slump in peace, the partial minister repeated his experience for the third time. We dropped together. Obviously we separated. Obviously she should be here by now. There are many simple explanations. Didn't I say there was no need for any fuss or formal gathering? Is there no one with a home to go home to? Fish to fry, nets to mend? It's my granddaughter's first time through. It's a ponderous journey. There's nothing new here. The dissatisfied villagers swept their attentions back to Mrs. Gramshaw, who was now roving her face just above the slick stone, like a jeweler studying the facets of a private gem. Sometimes you could see a mild spark here or there in the deeper rock, as sneaky as a shooting star. But the lodestone was dull throughout, devoid of any incoming traveller from Meadowlark, which, to Keepsy Gramshaw, could mean only one thing. She won't be arriving by way of the stone, Mrs. Gramshaw announced, her fingers falling into a settled knot at her chest. Keepsy, the parcel minister groaned. This was exactly the kind of extreme talk he'd spoken to her about. Even if it was, in theory, possible, such wild speculation should be reserved for himself and the members of the counting house. Powerful persons shepherd the miserable items of emergency, he told her, and not just once. He shot her a stormy look that he hoped might more firmly govern her. There's no other answer, she went on, ignoring him. The stone is empty and unlit. You can see for yourself. Mrs. Gramshaw stood to her full height and began to slowly turn to face them all. My guess is that she's already arrived, and is, at this very moment, in some unexpected part of Olive. There was a gasp and a vague casting about. Mrs. Gramshaw continued slowly and quietly as she tended the upsetting news. I'm sure Kittery is here now, and if that's the rare case, she'll very likely be engloomed. Mrs. Gramshaw issued the last word in the small box of a whisper, yet she could not remove the cold sting. Engloomed. The terrible word was touched upon by 20 tongues. Ladies of the council leaned toward their fishermen husbands to murmur a meaningful reminder. If the little girl has passed elsewhere, she'll most likely be engloomed, meaning she won't be able to move or feel anything for some time. The girl has not been engloomed, Keepsy, the partial minister said in a hot rush.
I am quite confident of this, Rudyard, Mrs. Gramshaw said, looking past the partial minister and out over the slate roofs of the village, scanning the red horizon with her award-winning eyes. She is here. She is engloomed. If she is in the forest or somewhere in town, we have little to fear. But, of course, she may have passed to the sea, Mrs. Gramshaw pointed out to the massive ironworks of water. At once, hands shot to brows and legs leapt to action as the residents of Olive spread over Second Hill and began to gaze down toward the twinkling ocean. A few of the younger men set off at a run for Barrow Beach. Mrs. Gramshaw continued, a little louder as the villagers had now begun to move down the hill. She may be standing in the shoals, she may be just off the beach,
but as the tide is coming in, the water rising fast, it is clearly urgent that we make our way to the waves as quickly as possible." Mrs. Gramshaw extended to her full height, and she stared, with remarkable stillness, at the silver-dented ocean. "Mr. Nundine will stay with me here at the Heights," Mrs. Gramshaw said. "If we see anything, we will direct you along. When Archie and Muck return from Meadowlark, we shall send young Archie up in the wings to alert the Sea Minister. Search the harbour, search the shoals, and out between the boats in the murky waters of Small Bay." Mrs. Gramshaw's lower lip rippled with distress as she found her final words. "If you find her, you must not, under any circumstance, move her. Get word back at once. Regardless of any danger you perceive, she must not be moved. Now go." The villagers tumbled down Second Hill, hands on hats, clutching dresses, some of them running for the first time in years. The partial minister rolled his hands away from his face, his sour habit during these days of diminished power. He put his feet on the path. He would have a nice bath and then go directly to bed. In the morning, he was sure, there would be news. Good news. The girl would be fine. Tardy to the stone, but clearly fine. Not engloomed. Good Lord, no. He would be right, and she would be wrong. He would have to find a delicate, but delicious way to remind them all of Mrs. Gramshaw's fear-mongering mischief. As the PM descended the hill, he could hear the tall housekeeper going on and on. "Mr. Nundine," she said, "would you be so kind as to deliver our message?" A small bear of a fisherman who stayed behind turned from the sun and came toward her. He looked as though he'd started off life as a pile of hair. His face was almost completely enclosed in brown beards, and only the smallest dots of skin could be seen below his eyes. "What'll we say?" he asked in his curling fisherman's voice. For 3 years running, he'd won the Speaking at Distance prize at the annual Olive Fair. It was the same fair where, year after year, Mrs. Gramshaw won the Seeing at Distance prize. Mrs. Gramshaw sighed in consideration and then finally said, "Just tell her we're looking for her, that she's not to worry, that she should not be too deeply alarmed by her inability to move or feel, that there are remedies we shall undertake, that we are, all of us, deeply in her debt. Tell her that she will be in our arms soon," Mrs. Gramshaw said, and there were tears in her excellent eyes. The fisherman nodded grimly and inhaled a long, cavernous breath until a tea kettle's whistle streamed from his nose. And then Mr. Nundine released the travelling, musical thunder of his voice. But by that time, Gittery was beyond his reach, standing in the deep ocean blackness, paralyzed and numb and scared.
"Lay down my armor and send me to sleep like a boat on the harbor into horse cows and sea. There's a boy in the mountain laying down in the stars, and the one with my heart lost a heart to the war." Silently whisper to the wind and forget the sin. There's a boat on the
Archie watched the sun dropping toward the sea as he ran. It was a discouraging view. Mrs. Gramshaw was still calling out her endless instructions from the top of Second Hill, warning him not to move Kittery if he found her in the water, reminding him that he needed to hit the water at speed. But Archie knew all this, and better than her. He wasn't looking for Kittery, and he knew how hard he had to hit the water. He knew what was needed. Even his father was struggling down the hill after him, muttering similar directions. "Just get to the wings, Archie, and over the sea as quick as you can before sunset. I'll be coming out in the rigger to fetch you. Do it just like we practiced." It was like they didn't trust him. As he came to the flats, Archie saw with frustration that the sun had neatly tucked its chin into the smooth blanket of the sea. If the sun went down, there'd be no chance for him to find the Sea Minister today. The soft grass dissolved into a scrubby sand, but Archie picked up speed as he reached the cobbled way. He listened to the slap of his bare feet against the worn grid of stones as he ran down Main Street. Normally, he would be hearing the distinct clatter of dinner plates and tea kettles. There'd be the waft of buttered bread, the sweetened air of dessert fruit and cream, the salt and peppered oil of cooked fish. But Main Street was empty. Everyone was out, looking for Kittery. He could see the villagers in quick blurry snatches, here and there patrolling the beach waters, some in boats, some swimming about, their long shadows reaching over the sands. When the road turned and lifted toward the stony white palace on First Hill, Archie jumped off and down into the rippling dunes. His feet dragged in the heavy sand until they hit the harder darkness at the water's edge. He ran the coastline until there was no more beach, and then he climbed up the rocks and raced over the final stretch, a narrow, sea-grass jetty that spindled out into the ocean. Archie scowled when he saw that the oil lamp in the toppled lighthouse was already burning. He jumped past the fallen beacon and stumbled down the steep goat path. He remembered coming here as a very young boy. It seemed so far away back then, he and his friends peering through the cracks in the stall where the wings were kept. The sun was halfway gone as his hand fell on the wooden door peg. He leapt into the darkness of the stall and drew the wings from their pins. Even at the door, he could feel them pulling for him. He brought them quickly outside into the fading light, and the mass of brown feathers shivered wide and clamped around his arms. He spun beneath them and looked down the cliffs. White spume painted the dark rocks below. The wings tightened greedily over his back, and Archie winced at the familiar sharp pain of ingression, when boy and wings fused together and became one. He took a few steps toward the cliff edge and stared down the 100-foot drop. He didn't bother testing the wings, but simply tipped forward and plunged headlong into the wind. He remembered the day he'd been chosen, a line of children standing on the dusty promontory, waiting for their turn, for the wings to be set over their shoulders. It seemed impossible, so unlikely. He'd always wanted to fly, but so had everyone else. Some of the children wept when the wings failed to adhere and just sat limply over their small backs. When it was his turn, Archie had cried too. The wings had attacked him, clamped down wrongly over his chest. It felt like his bones were being shattered from the inside.
He dove through the rushing winds, feet pointed, wings tucked, shooting straight for the shipwrecked rocks below. When he tasted salt at the back of his throat, he pulled up and shot forward in a line just above the water, and then his wings slowly spread to their limit, and he began to rise. He stroked the air with the reaching supple feathers and felt the surging power of flight. From this vantage, Archie could see his father, now setting out from the wharves, the arrowhead sails of his rigger shooting the knife-like boat across the waves. Archie pumped his wings and went higher. The world quieted below him. The higher he went, the stiller everything looked, until he reached that beautiful and exhausted spot where the great bird soared. There was still just enough light that he could make out the features underwater. The buried islands, the old sunken riggers and schooners, the bird-like schools of fish. He soared over the bay, heading toward the furrowed trench. It was here, along the trench line, that he'd find the Sea Minister. A huge gust pumped him toward the clouds. He leveled and struggled down against the towering winds until he'd regained control. When he saw the sinewy, egg-like shape pulsing along in the green depths, not far from the trench, a happy thrill shot through his body. He wished he had Mr. Nundine's voice. He could call out to the entire village the fact of his discovery. But Mrs. Gramshaw would know. She'd have been watching him the entire time, would see him shooting like a missile into the waves. She'd know that he'd found the minister. She would tell Mr. Nundine, and Mr. Nundine would call it out, and Archie's father would hear it. He closed his wings around his legs and pointed his toes away. The wind howled into his head as he fell faster and faster toward the dark shape of the Sea Minister. He tried not to think about what would happen when he hit. The waves still seemed far away when a heavy bar of water rammed down his throat. His head exploded in stars as it hit the water. His eyes spun in a chaos of pink sky and slapping waves. He bobbed upward in the sea as the wings released him. His chest was full of water. As he fell unconscious, he felt the thorny, stinging tentacles of the enormous octopus grappling around his body and face. Archie was thankful he was done. He didn't have to experience the next part. His work was through. When he woke next, he would be on his father's boat. It might be in 10 minutes. It might be tomorrow. However long it took for the Sea Minister to extract the information from his brain, the message that Kittery Embers had arrived, that she was in the sea, that his special services were required. The constricting arms of the ancient creature enclosed the half-drowned boy and carried him down into the gone-away world of the deep, deep trench. I walked down the path through the woods, the falling snow, my neighbor, black as ice, a silver dream, as we go skating down the stream. Uncontrolled, peacefully.